guys coming in today in the morning and in the evening, which one are you gonna do? I'm like, both.
Gary Brown, Super Bowl champion, and more importantly, difference maker through his Dream 68 Foundation.
I started playing ball at a young age. I played all sports, and the reality was I was just a coachable kid. Kudos to my dad, because he wasn't just a dad to me, he was a dad to the neighborhood. Like, so he would have his Chevy and be like, what are you doing on the street? Get in the car, you're playing football now. And this is at a young age. Like, whether you had money or didn't have money, whether you had shoes or you didn't have shoes, that's what he did. But my dad taught me a lot, man. That work ethic, that grind. Everybody has tough times, and they never let us know. You know what I mean?
God has this plan for you. Now you're leveling up. You built the confidence you need. You're in the NFL. You're restarting. Now you're at the bottom of the rung again. Nobody screaming your name. Nobody knows who you are.
So when the scouts were coming to see the 10 other players that Georgia Tech had on the roster to be drafted, when they were running the 40-yard dash on this side of the field, I was on this side of the field running the 40-yard dash. When they went in the weight room to do that bench press, I went in the weight room to do the bench press. When they were doing that high jump, I just so happened to be practicing my high jump at the same time. And that got me noticed. I got myself noticed. You know, my agent was like, Gary, you got guys coming in today. In the morning and in the evening, which one are you going to do? I'm like, both.
Welcome to the Real Mentors Podcast, where we interview real examples altering lives. And today, my guest is the one and only Brentwood, New York's own Gary Brown, Super Bowl champion, and more importantly, difference maker through his Dream 68 Foundation. Gary, welcome to the show. How are you doing today, brother?
I'm doing awesome. Thank you guys for having me. Wonderful place you have here. Good
stuff. Thank you. We're introducing Gary to the South Bronx. It's not everything you believe it to be. We got some good shit going on down here. We're trying to change it up. Thank you for making the trek out from Long Island, which is a similar trek that I make these days, but well worth it to have the fresh air and all that good stuff. Brentwood, we've heard of it. You know, I'm from the Bronx, New York. We know about Long Island. We always have our perceptions of what Long Island is when you're not from there or you don't know, just like they may have their perception of what the Bronx is. If
Absolutely.
You haven't walked the streets, there's different neighborhoods in the Bronx. Tell us a little bit about growing up in Brentwood. How did that look for you? What was the family structure? And when did you start playing ball?
Well, I started playing ball at a young age. I played all sports. And, you know, kudos to my dad, because he wasn't just a dad to me. He was a dad to the neighborhood. Like, so he would have his Chevy and be like, what are you doing on the street? Get in the car. You're playing football now. And this is at a young age. Like, whether you had money or didn't have money, whether you had shoes or you didn't have shoes, that's what he did. And we're idle and not doing nothing. We played all sports, even if you didn't like it. Baseball, basketball, football, soccer, lacrosse. You're doing something. And that was cool. You know, people thank my dad to this day. But Brentwood's a very special place in my heart because, one, it made me who I am. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's where you come from and that grit and that grind that you learn at a young age. And we have a really bad, bad stigma about Brentwood because you only hear bad news. Right. You hear about gang violence, you hear about the MS, and you hear about shootings, and it happens everywhere.
Right.
But when it happens in my neighborhood, it's on the news. Right. When it happens in neighboring neighborhoods, it's kind of buried, and you only hear about the good work that they're doing. So I challenge people to visit Brentwood and taste some of the authentic food and see some of the authentic people and some of the homegrowns that really love that population. I feel that I was very lucky because, like, when I was young, my school went from predominantly white one year to the very next year was predominantly black, and then the very next year was predominantly Spanish in 3 years. And the caliber of education and the kids going to college and getting scholarships is high. It ranks with the best of schools. So I'm very proud of that, and it made me who I am.
Wow. So big thing, you know, same thing, growing up in the Bronx, you don't realize that at the time it's just life. You know, people, you don't realize that you're getting toughened up. And, you know, Brentwood has nice neighborhoods too. Brentwood has it all. My office is actually in Brentwood. And the food choices are some of the best in Long Island, so I'm definitely, I have an affinity for the place for that reason and nothing else. You mentioned your dad being the neighborhood dad. Was he a ball player too, or just through leisure?
You know, funny, my dad grew up and he was really good at baseball, and he probably had a scholarship coming out of high school to play baseball. But him and my mom were together, and I think she was, you know, soon pregnant, and he elected to go to work and not pursue a college, if he could go to college, not pursue that. And that was his last playing. But we grew up playing ball with him, baseball, basketball. Like, even as a young child, I remember going to the gyms at night and playing pickup ball with him and his friends. And he always made sure we stayed busy. But my dad taught me a lot, man. That work ethic, that grind, you know, him and my mother, you know, everybody has tough times and they never let us know it. You know what I mean? And that's good parenting. You know, they, right. Oh, guess what, kids? We're having breakfast for dinner tonight. And we're like, yay, but it's because there wasn't nothing else in
that's
there.
All
you
it
know
was.
What I mean? Payday was the next day, you know what I'm saying? Or whatever. But they always made it a way of making everything fun. Blackouts. Oh, we're sleeping together under candles and we're camping. You know what I mean? They just knew how to take the pressure off of letting us be kids. But they both come from large Southern families. My father's from one of, I think, 13 from Alabama, Mobile, Alabama, not just Alabama, Mobile.
South,
So, you know, outhouses, I did that. You know what I mean?
Right.
Lizards and running around the house, I did that. You know, and my mom's from Emporia, Virginia, where they had outhouses and dirt roads well into the 80s, late 80s, you know, and it's like, you guys still got well water pumping from your front yard and outhouses in the back, but it's real. And that's something I don't take for granted because I see where they come from.
Right.
My father grew up with 13 kids in a one-bedroom house. How do you do that? You know what I mean? One kid pees in the bed, everybody peed in the bed. You know what I mean? Because everybody got wet. But that's what...
One at the head, one at the foot,
but
one
that's
in between.
But that's how they lived.
And you know, so...
For us to be like, I got to share a room with my brother is kind of spoiled, you know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
So he was like, boy, sharing a room, try sharing it with the whole family, you know what I mean? So that he always reminded me of how he grew up and how to be thankful for what we have. And that's why I am who I am. You know, I'm a very appreciative person for, you know, trials and tribulations in life and my upbringing.
We talked about football and your dad introducing you to it. When do you start to get serious? When do you start to realize, like, I'm talented?
That's funny because, you know, growing up in these neighborhoods, you play with your friends a lot. So I love basketball. I love basketball more than any other sport. You know, any big guy always thinks they're a point guard and they could do this and do that, three at the last second. And the reality was I was just a coachable kid. And I learned that from this guy named Mr. John in ninth grade. And he pulled me to the side, and he was my science teacher. Actually, he recently just passed away. Prayers out to him and his family. But he taught me at a young age. I was grew up a quarterback all through Little League, and I went into junior high school playing quarterback. And he was like, I'm going to let you play quarterback, but look at your hands, look at your feet. You're not gonna be a quarterback. You're gonna be a big boy. You're gonna be an offensive lineman or a tight end or a defensive lineman. So I'll let you play quarterback as long as you play every other position I tell you to play in practice. And I'm like, cool. And that opened the game up for me. That let me learn how defense thinks, offense thinks. I was able to catch the ball because, like I said, I was a basketball player. I had soft hands, I had a soft touch. I was an athlete. I just wasn't fast enough to play quarterback. Or play tight end or anything like that, but I was coachable. And then, you know, 10th grade, I got into girls and hanging out, and I was like, you know what, I'm not playing football. This after-school stuff over here is more fun. But then on Fridays, I saw the guys walking around with their jerseys the day before the game, and I was like, damn, I missed that.
Right.
Very next year, 11th grade, I went and tried out for the team, and the coach told me, these are different. Now I'm growing up, I got a different coach. I'm in the high school. And in front of everybody, he said, Mr. Brown, you might as well get up and leave the gym now because you'll never make my team. And I was like, wow. But nobody really knew who I was, so I just sat there because I was too embarrassed to get up and walk out. So when everybody went out on the field, I went out on the field with them. He was like, I thought I told you to quit. And I said, I'm not going to quit. And you cut me, but I'm not going to quit. Never told my dad because my dad would have had words with that man, you know? But, because my dad's very protective. But so I took a lot of abuse, like, I'm going to make you quit, stay after practice, and do up-downs or run the field, and that was wrong. He was real hard on me. And I look back on it, and it made me who I, you know, those things made me stronger. It was like, shit, if they could do it, I could do it. You know what I mean? So He wanted me to go to like Southern Connecticut, who was like 1-9 and 0-10.
Right, local
and
school.
I'm like, Coach, I'm done losing, man. We've been losing here for 2 years.
I'm good at losing.
You know, and you didn't even play me, and I was losing. You know, and I'm clearly better than the guy in front of me. I'm going to try my luck at Nassau Community College. And he sat down and told me, he was like, that's why you're never going to be nothing, Gary, because you don't listen. Uh-huh. He was like, good luck. Get out of my office. And that was the that was the last time I seen him for years. Went to Nassau. Blessings to that place. Nassau Community College, one, is one of the best junior colleges on the East Coast. They get all the talent from the Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens, Long Island, Jersey, all the guys that are athletic enough to play Division One, but didn't have the grades or had a juvenile record.
Right.
Or, you know, 30, 40 years ago, getting into college, they look into your background. You know, what kid hasn't stolen a piece of gum from the supermarket or the deli and got in trouble? You know what I mean? Like, right. Silly stuff like that. But they held that against you. Or at some schools, clearly, they didn't even take kids from broken homes, which is like, it's not the norm now, but back then they were like, oh, he's from a broken home. He's just, you know.
There were stereotypes. There were investments that are going to be made. You are higher risk if you don't have your shit together.
Absolutely.
And, you know, let's be honest, when you come from where we come from, there's a higher likelihood of not having your shit together.
I mean, and there's people that ruined it for us. That, you know, absolutely. I played with players that went on to Division One who fought security guards and police and stole and did this and did right. that. You know
no
what I mean?
Shit.
Which is ruining it for the next person behind you. But playing at that level at Nassau, which I went in there a boy, I wasn't ready for what they had. These dudes were jacked up. They were playing. They were playing hard. And I'm like, oh, snap, what did I step into? But getting punched in the face teaches you a lesson. It teaches you how to take it, how to duck it, how to respond to it. And it just, you learn from your peers. And I grew fast. In those 2 years, man, I went in not knowing the philosophy of football to leaving like, yo, I'm leaving a bunch of hungry wolves behind me and going to Georgia Tech and getting there seeing some spoiled kids that take this stuff for granted. I'm right. like, do you know there's guys that I just left at Nassau that will die to be in your position,
right.
to have a mess hall where they got steak and lobster and pasta every day, and you're talking about, oh, I'm going to go eat here. I don't want to eat this junk. What are you talking about, bro? We eating bagels and bags of chips in the parking lot and sleeping in our car at Nassau, and you got all of this? Like, come on, there's no reason for you not to, you know, grow with the program. You got a weight room bigger and better than any gym that was on Long Island. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I'm like, we worked out in a closet with one bench, one squat rack, and some dumbbells, you know what I mean, as a whole team. So it was good to go through those. Because then when you step up, you appreciate it more.
Right.
And when I went there, I was ready. I was ready. I was hungry. I was like, yo, nah, I'm not from New York. I'm from Brentwood, New York. And I'm going to teach you about where we from. You know what I mean? I'm representing a bunch of hungry wolves from Nassau. And I'm representing Brentwood and all the athletes that I left behind. And I carry that on my back always. Win, lose, or draw.
And you never took the easy road or the traditional route. Because it's rare that you'll find a professional ball player coming out of any community college setting. Victor Cruz was a big deal for the Giants when he was doing it. I didn't even know that about your story. So kudos to you. It sounds like you were a bit of a late bloomer in terms of your sports prowess.
Mm-hmm.
But God has a plan, right? Because you come into this senior college setting now. And E.T., Eric Thomas, Hip Hop Preacher, has this great clip where he's talking about, y'all talk about the grind, but y'all don't know what the grind is because y'all been praised since middle school. But here you are, you coming in as a 20-year-old and you still got the hunger, whereas these, you know, big-time school kids been followed and recruited and had their asses kissed for the last 8 years since they was kids.
Yes.
So what does that now look like going from community college, still being on the grind, to now you're in the shit? Now you're with the big boys.
Well, you know, going through that it's a blessing because if I was blessed enough to leave high school to get a scholarship to a Division I school, I guarantee you I would have ruined it.
Yep.
You know, that's the first time the leash is getting taken off. You know, I don't have my mother and dad to tell me what time to be home or look at me in my eyes, let me smell your breath kind of thing. And I'm out and I get to go do what I want when I want. I would have ate that cafeteria dry, hung out and drank all day and night because that's what we did. You know
sounds
what I
like
mean?
My first year of college but when you, I transferred over.
So yeah. I wasn't ready. Like, I would have ruined that opportunity. I would have took it for granted, like a lot of the people that got that went there did. So Nassau, it just reminded me of athletes that were probably better than me or probably just as talented or hungry that will never get that opportunity. So I played with a little grudge. I played with a little chip on my shoulder just because I wasn't just playing for me. I was playing for other players behind me and showing that that well is good to go to. And believe it or not, there's a lot more players in the NFL from junior college or Division III's. But what happens is when you transfer or they draft you from a bigger school, that's all they will label.
Gotcha.
So if you see me in the NFL or Pittsburgh, Green Bay, or San Francisco, it says Gary Brown from Georgia Tech, because that's where they drafted me from.
Gotcha.
But when I do an interview, I make sure they know Nassau Community College and Brentwood. You know what I mean? Because you got to rep it, man. I'm proud of where I come from, very proud. And despite the negative stigma, nah, there's a lot of beautiful things that come out of there.
So you drafted from Georgia Tech straight to the NFL by the Pittsburgh Steelers,
yes,
if I'm not
round.
Mistaken.
Yep.
What does that transition look like? You're going from, you know, Hungry Wolves to the big boys, and now you're going to the league.
So that's funny. I got a whole scenario of how that played out. So leaving Georgia Tech, first it took me a second to adapt and to, I'm used to 100 or 200 people at a game, till you go into Georgia Tech where you got 50,000 screaming fans that know who you are. And it's like, oh, snap, you know me? Like, that's a change right there. And then being able to first adapt, compete, and then achieve at a higher level was awesome. But then when you step up to the next level, it's like you're back down on the bottom, adapting, learning, fitting in again. And I just look at it like this. When you're in Little League, maybe out of the whole Little League, there might be one or two kids that are like exceptional athletes.
Right.
And then when you get to high school, you know, a couple of teams in high school may have an exceptional athlete. Then you get to junior college. Now you got everybody there is somewhat of an athlete, some of them a little bit more gifted. But when you get to Division I, everybody's a shit where they come from. Everybody has that smoke. Everybody has that funk. You know what I mean? And it's like, all right, I got a whole team. And then even at that level, there's one or two or three athletes that stand out. But when you get to the NFL, nobody's there by mistake. Nobody's there by accident. Nobody bribed their way in. It's earned blood, sweat, and tears. And their resume speaks for themselves. So every practice, every play, every drill is a test. And it's man on man. It's like, are you going to let this guy from Oklahoma or Nebraska beat you, or are you going to rep? And so I took everything as a challenge accepted. Let's go. You know, true story, I knew, you said, when did I know the trend? I had something, and it started at Nassau, because when I first got there, I had these skinny arms. I never worked out. Like, us working out was, you know, some play stuff for a half an hour. These guys were in there jacked and working out for real. And my first play was against this dude, and he was jacked, you know, muscles coming out of his shoulder pads and arms tied up. Every day he looked like an NFL player. And I'm like, oh man, this guy's gonna crush me. And I'm being honest, total fear. I'm down in my stance, and the coach blew the whistle, and out of pure fear, I closed my eyes and just lunged off the ball. I hit him in his mouth, and he fell on his ass. And I jumped up and ran to the back of the line and was like, whew, thank God that's over. And he got up pissed. Get that rookie back up here. Nobody does that to me. And blah, blah, blah. And he's foaming at the mouth. And I'm like, oh, my God. They're like, Brown, back to the front. And I'm like, oh, my God. So I noticed something right there. This guy is so strong and like, if he puts his hands on me, he's going to throw me like a rag doll. But if I get all up into him first, he's not going to have that opportunity. So when the coach is doing the cadence and he got ready to blow the whistle, I'm like, I'm jumping it. I'm going to leave early. I'm going to have to get into him, because if he beats me to me, then I'm right. Finished. Took off, hit him in his mouth again. And now the whole team's watching. And right. They're patting me on the back, and they're hitting me on the head. And I noticed, you know what? I got to play offense aggressively. I got to play it like with a defensive mentality. I can't sit back and take the beating and wait for what they're going to do. I'm going to dictate what they're going to do. If they're faster than me, I'm going to be stronger than them. If they're stronger than me, I'm going to be faster. If they're faster and stronger, I'm going to outwit them. I'm going to lean to the right when I'm going left. I'm going to act like I'm pass blocking when I'm run blocking. I'm going to, you know, cheat the system to make it work in my favor. Right. If you're reading me, my hands, I'm going to dig in the dirt. And, you know, all the tricks of the trade, I learned at an early age. And just so I could survive, then it was my secret weapon. You know what I mean? Right. Then it was, and then I noticed because of basketball, my feet were a little bit quicker than every other 300-pounder.
Right.
So now I'm out there dancing with everybody. Let's go. I could get that linebacker all the way over there. I get that safety coming off the end. Mm-hmm. I could pull block and knock that end out. Let's go. My helmets are specimens because they got nicks and grooves in them. And it's not because I was getting hit. It's because I was hitting people. And I prided myself on that.
Nice. So it becomes a mental game for you on some level. And you spoke about not getting that shot, that opportunity to go to Georgia Tech too early being a blessing. And the reason being is your mentality, you weren't ready for it. You know, my first year in college, no sports involved, but the brakes were off after that first year, partying and shitty grades and just doing a damn thing. So I can't even imagine from a football perspective what that looks like in college, because we used to chill with the football players and there was no shortage of a good time there. So God has this plan for you. Now you're leveling up. You built the confidence you need. You're in the NFL. You're restarting. You know, that looks different. Now you're at the bottom of the rung again. You know, nobody's screaming your name. Nobody knows who you are, except for the defensive coaches probably at this point. What does this time in your life look like from a personal standpoint? Are you eating, breathing, and living football, or do you still have some of the things that you came up with tugging at you on a personal side?
I think you always have those things tugging at you on a personal side, but maturity helps you curb them. There's a time and a place for everything, you know? And so the short answer is yes, I still had those things tugging at me. I love a good time. I love hanging out. I love doing that. Time and place for it. When I got drafted to Pittsburgh, it was an honor because somebody wanted me. You know, I got myself drafted. Like, before draft, I wasn't even on the board. I was maybe a walk-on. My senior year in college at Georgia Tech, I hurt my knee. They were like, if we give you surgery, you can make it back for the last game. And I'm like, I'm not doing surgery for one game.
Right.
I rehabbed, and I came back for the last game anyway. And I happened to play against a guy named, I think, Mitch Davis from Georgia. And he needed like a half a sack to break the school record or tie it. And I shut him down. It was a great game. That got me a little bit of attention, but not enough. So when the scouts were coming to see the 10 other players that Georgia Tech had on the roster to be drafted, when they were running the 40-yard dash on this side of the field, I was on this side of the field running the 40-yard dash. When they went in the weight room to do that bench press, I went in the weight room to do the bench press. When they were doing that high jump, I just so happened to be practicing my high jump at the same time. And after doing that three or four times, the scouts were like, well, if these are these guys, who's that over there? And they were like, oh, that's Gary. He had a knee injury. They were like, well, his knee looks good now. Let me time him. And that got me noticed. I got myself noticed. You know, my agent was like, Gary, you got guys coming in today in the morning and in the evening. Which one are you going to do? I'm like, both. You know what I mean? You never know where opportunity knocks. Right. So that got me on the radar, and I ended up being the first one drafted from Georgia Tech out of all the 10 guys that were supposed to go in the first, second, and third round. You know what I mean? And so that was like, oh, wow. You know, and at the time, it was like on the ticker on the television. It's not live like it is now. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right. It wasn't as
so
big
it was
deal.
Like a 15-minute delay. So after I talked to the coaches on the phone and hung up, I'm like, is this for real? I got to see it on ESPN first. And as soon as I saw my name go across the bottom of the screen, I was like, Mom, Dad, I did it. We made it. We made it. We made it. We made it. And that was a blessing. You know what I mean? And now a new chapter begins. So going to Pittsburgh, I'm practicing against Greg Lloyd and Kevin Green, like two of the NFL's greats. You know what I mean? I'm behind Steven Jackson, a Hall of Famer from Pittsburgh. they love me, I love them. It was like a family, and it was like us against the world. It was built for me, the Steel City, the blue collar police. Yep. It was just grit, it was grind, it was everything I represented, and I wanted to represent it. And you know, sometimes it hurts getting comfortable because I was accepting, taking less money and being on a practice squad to develop for a year to fall into the role behind Steven Jackson. And I wanted to, but you have to clear waivers for 24 hours. And in those 24 hours, Green Bay picked me up like that. And I'm like, Green Bay?
Where is that? I'm from a kid
from Brentwood that went to Georgia and thought I was on a world vacation. Green Bay, I heard of it, but I don't know where that's at on the map. I don't know, you know? And there's a reason, you know? I got off that plane, I was like, whoa, culture shock, you know? Yeah, and your life changes like that overnight. Like, they acquired me, my playbook was handed in within 15 minutes, the duffel bag was packed, next morning I was at the airport flying to a new home, just like that. No goodbyes, no nothing, just gone. And at a new place. And so I told you I had a funny story about that. So now I've been practicing against Kevin Green and Greg Lloyd. I'm ready for anybody in the NFL. Right. I'm 315 pounds or like 8% body fat. Bring on the world. I don't care who it is. First day of practice with Green Bay was game one, week one of the first game. And it's an unwritten thing in the NFL where you start taking it easy on each other because getting the guys ready for the game on Sunday. The coach said, they're going to tell you to take it easy. You're applying for a job. You give it 110%. If you slack off, you'll be on the first plane back home. All right. First play, I'm Gary Brown. I was going against Gilbert Brown. Already animosity. I got a white Cherokee. He got a white Cherokee. They both got G Brown on the license plate. I'm like, yo, you gotta be kidding me. So this guy is already like, yo, there's no two G Browns. I'm G Brown, that's Brown. And I'm like, I don't know how that works out, but I'm willing to do whatever we gotta do. First play is against him. They tell me, go all out. I come off, I hit him in the mouth. Buckles his chin strap up. He's like, yo, somebody better teach this rookie how to practice, or I'm gonna do it for him. Second play, this is that guard. Second play, I go against him again. I don't take it easy. I hit him in the mouth again. Now he grabs my helmet. We get into a tussle. I'm like, damn, I'm making enemies on the team before I even made a friend. Now everybody in the defense is pointing and talking about me. And I'm like, oh boy, here we go. Move out to tackle. First play against Reggie White is the backside of a sweep play. So everything's going that way. All I really do, I do is distract him, get in his way. I don't got to hit him or anything. Just get in his way, slow his pace down, and I did my job. Not me. I take a step down, I crack back, I hit Reggie. Reggie said, okay. Fourth play is a pass play. I'm like, I don't care. I've been going against
Sorry,
Kevin.
As a normal human being here, I'm just laughing. You it's can like, see how this is going. The Reggie Brown.
The Reggie White. And so
Reggie White,
the fourth play, it was a pass play. And Reggie slides up outside, and I'm like, I'm ready. I've been doing this all camp. I'm ready. I do my set. I do my steps, and he takes off, and he puts his arm underneath me and humps me, grabs me underneath my body, lifts me up, all 315, 310 pounds off the ground. My toes are like this on the ground. I'm like, oh, my God. This guy's about to pile drive me, and I'm at his mercy. And then he just grabbed me and pulled me in and was like, now slow down, rookie. And I was like, yes, sir, Mr. White. You know what I mean? Because it was only respectful.
Of course.
They had to respect my hustle, but if I'd have bowed down to it, they wouldn't have respected me. And then, you know, then I slowed down. And then I went in the huddle, and everybody was laughing. And they were like, good job, Brown, good job. They were laughing at me, but it was a test.
Right.
I earned friends and enemies. Gilbert was still a little mad at me, but I earned the respect of my teammates off the rip. And
2G Browns, what are the chances?
What are the odds, right?
You know, you mentioned Reggie White, the infamous, famous, I mean, just enough can't be said about what he brought to the game. And here you are, kid from Brentwood, New York. Holy shit. Is there a bit of starstruck? I mean, you know, you win your championship in 97. What year is this? 94, 95?
Yes.
Okay.
94.
So you're already around Reggie White, Brett Favre, Mike Holmgren's coaching. I mean, you're talking all-time Hall of Fame,
yep,
greats. What are some of the things you're picking up in terms of work ethic, championship caliber mentality, the differences between, you know, that team camaraderie that you just talked about where you just hit him in the mouth. He wasn't too happy about it, but, you know, we're all on the same team. You gave him shit. You got your shit. That's your indoctrination process. But, you know, when the dust settles and now you're part of the team, what does that work ethic look like?
Looking back on it, it means more to me now than it did at the time. Excuse me. And I did not have the respect for what they call the Mamba mentality with Kobe Bryant when he was alive. When he passed away, I dug a little deeper into it, and I hear more interviews about what it means to him and how he portrayed it with his lifestyle and with other players and how he dealt with and talked to other people. And then I play back my career, and it makes sense. Like, the greats are great because of that. Reggie White, Brett Favre, Sean Jones, Keith Jackson, all Pro Bowlers, greats in the sport, played a long time. These guys were the first in the locker room every day and the last to leave. I'm still young. Practice is over, we're in meetings going through practice, and I'm like, yo, what time are we getting out of here? I got things to do. You know what I mean? Like, how this you said it's going to be an hour. It's an hour, 15 minutes. Me and half the team are meeting somewhere else. Like, right. You know what I mean? But these guys would stay and watch film again and work out again. Or even when I played with San Francisco, Steve Young, Jerry Rice, Bryant Young, these guys, by the time we had to be to work, let's say it's 7 o'clock in the morning or 8 o'clock in the morning, I would get there half an hour early, enough time to settle down, change, open my playbook before I go to my meeting. These guys already had a workout. They already did a film session. They already went through the playbook and showered and welcoming guys in for the next. That's Mamba mentality. You're Jerry Rice. Why are you in here practicing routes by yourself at 6 in the morning and doing it again at 6 at night when everybody's gone? You're the greatest to ever do it. You know what I mean? But he didn't get that way by being normal and doing what I did and surviving on my talent. And don't get me wrong, I worked a little hard and I worked my ass off. But I didn't have that Mamba mentality when I was playing. And that Mamba mentality converts to life. Right. There's people, you know, that I do real estate. I did real estate. I signed my license. But you need the Mamba mentality to do real estate. You're going to get out what you put in. For the people who get up at 5 in the morning and make sure their social media posts are up to par for an hour or two, and then they send the emails to their follow-ups for another hour, and then they're doing new, fresh emails to reach new leads, and then they're going on their daily schedule to show people houses, and then they're finishing their day at 7, 8 o'clock at night. Those are the people that are going to get results. For people that go into it saying, oh, I want to do real estate to be my own boss because I want to be able to go on vacation when I want to and get up when I want to and go to bed, then you're in it for the wrong reason. You're better off working a 9-to-5, working for somebody. You're going to get more money out of that. When you're your own boss, you got to work harder than you got to have that Mamba mentality because you're only cheating yourself. When you're having a 3-hour lunch, that means there's 2.5 hours you're not working. You know what I mean? That's taken away from your payday. So that Mamba mentality quickly converts into life. Right. And everything that you do, from your health, to working out, family. We talked about family and how big and what that means to us. You got to put that same effort and time and energy into your family, into your loved ones. Because if not, they suffer. You know what I mean? That there's going to be something missing in that. And can you do it to everything? No, but you could die trying, you know? And so that Mamba mentality I saw it, but didn't recognize it until after my career. Actually, it was when I initially hurt myself that I started sitting back after feeling sorry for myself. It kind of adapted that. Like, everything I do is going to get 100% of my attention 100% of the time because I owe it to myself, and I'm thankful that I'm still around. I'm not, you know, paralyzed, or I'm not in a wheelchair, and I'm not miserable, or, you know, I had to get out of my own way before I could get on with my life. And that's the same thing with football. Playing left tackle, blindside, before the movie came out was something you had to have a short memory with. Because no matter how good your last play was, if you get too hyped, you're going to get beat the next play. And no matter how bad your last play was, if you let it suck you down in the dungeon, you're going to have a rough day. They're going to keep beating and pounding on you. So every play was a reset. Every play was a restart, a new chance to do the right thing, do your steps, hands inside, neck back, butt down, punch, jab, drive. Every play was a chance to do it perfect. And no matter what happened the last play, you got to treat it with that mama mentality every play. So it's a good transition.
You mentioned the movie The Blind Side, which made that position famous. You were also playing at a time where the quarterback wasn't as protected as they are now, much like in the NBA, same difference, you know, freedom of movement. How did that impact your play versus, let's say, if you were in the league now?
I think who you're playing with is a major difference. And I say that with all due respect with Aaron Rodgers and Brett Favre, because I use a comparison with them, because a lot of people say, which one would you take? And 100% Aaron Rodgers is a better quarterback, a better shape, better arm, more mindful of the game. He's a new caliber of quarterback. But I will take Brett Favre in my huddle any day because – one, of his work ethic, and two, he makes people around him better. So in that time, in that era where quarterbacks would, they, you know, get clotheslined and knees taken out and things like that, I prided myself on trying not to get him hit. And if he gets hit, I'm going to be the first one to pick him up, whether it's my guy or somebody else's guy. I'm 30 yards, 20 yards downfield. Get off of my player. Get my lineman up. Get my running back up. That's my mentality. That's how I was. And whenever I did give up a sack, get off my quarterback and I pick him up, and he would be like, don't worry, Gary, I got hit harder than that in Pee Wee. You know, and playing for a quarterback like that, you want to do better. You're like, oh my God, I can't let this happen again. Right. As to playing for a quarterback that's saying, come on, get your stuff together. You're making, you know, that gives you, you know, you're questioning yourself, and it can make you have a rough day. So I'm all for team. I think every kid, every person should play a team sport and a solo sport. A solo sport like swimming and boxing or whatever it may be is going to teach you to be the best version of yourself. But a team sport is going to teach you to be what everybody else needs you to be. Because I honestly was a better guard, offensive guard came easy to me because I had good feet and I was strong enough. I could handle anything in the guard position from here to here. This is my job.
Right.
I don't even got to go nowhere. You know what I mean? Tackle, my job could have been all the way out on the end over there. It could have been the guy coming off the corner over there. It could be the middle linebacker, the outside linebacker. It could be any of them. And, you know, that was a challenge. So I was an undersized guard, but I had good feet. So team sports teach you to be the best at whatever you have to do to make the team better. You know what I mean? And sacrificing your personal wants and needs or whatever for the team. And I think that's all of that converts to life. You know what I mean? Family, business.
Yeah, it's transferable skills. You know, the things that we learn can serve us in a positive or in a negative component, particularly in sports. You know, I grew up in the Bronx here. We didn't have a ton of sports programs because of my size, and I'm in shape now. I wasn't always in shape. I was like big, fat, goofy kid. They always, oh, where'd you play ball? I'm like, I used to play the saxophone.
I nice. Never played ball. Always wanted to do that.
Yeah, so, you know, we didn't necessarily have the programs here in the Bronx. We also didn't have the father figures and the mentors that came and picked us up and fucking played with us for hours. You mentioned some mentors along the way. Who would you say was your biggest NFL mentor? And is there anybody who has, you know, still been in touch with you or somebody you've been friends with over the years since leaving the league?
Ironically, that's funny you asked. I just saw this past weekend, I do an event in Tennessee that benefits the Children's Hospital and Ronald McDonald House. And I saw OG Bruce Wilkerson, who played with Reggie. And he is undeniably one of the reasons we won a Super Bowl, because he came onto the team. I was banged up. Earl Dotson, who's the right tackle, was banged up. And this guy played every position that the team needed, from guard, right guard, left tackle, right
utility
tackle.
Man, yeah.
And he played it well with no problems. And he was just an OG. This is a guy that played for the Raiders. He played everywhere. But he was an OG. And just sitting down this weekend with him and going through old times and realizing how much of a mentor he was, because he, you know, he was one of those guys, don't do this, do that. You're going against this guy, make sure you don't do this. You know, the altitude's going to be like this. Drink a lot of water, conserve your air, get rest. You know, like little things that you didn't think about as
veteran.
A young kid.
He's a veteran.
But an OG was like, and I'm like, damn, man, you know how much you meant to me? And you know, I'm a person that realizes things after the fact. And, I hugged it out with him. And that's what we do. I do keep in touch with some of the players. Actually, in 2 weeks, they have an alumni weekend. I don't know if I'm going to be able to make it due to my back, because I gotta confirm that I could do like all these 10 different events and golfing and skeet shooting and galas. So I'm like, let me deal with my health a little bit and then I'll be back next
year.
Got
the back dose for you, bro. I told you already.
Yes, yes, yes.
We're going to get you out to that reunion.
I try anything twice, bro. And that's another whole story. And that is... You know, when you talk about, you go through things and it gives you a new appreciation of life, and you can let it affect you one way or the other.
And let's talk about that. That's perfect, because, you know, up to this point, we're talking about your background, how you got into ball. You reached the pinnacle in 97. Green Bay Packers win the chip over the New England Patriots. Famously, Desmond Howard, only special teams ever win the MVP of the Super Bowl. And again, I'm not the biggest football fan, but I cannot, you know, I'm automatically, all right, Brett Favre, 99-yard kickoff return to start the game. You're part of that team. So now you got the Super Bowl ring, you win the chip. How much longer before your career takes an unexpected turn after that?
I'm not going to talk bad about anything, because let's just say football is a business. And when you're dealing with a multi-billion dollar business, there's always things that don't go your way. And sometimes you're a casualty. Sometimes you're a pawn. Sometimes you're an excuse. So after the Super Bowl, I was with the team the very next year. Midway through, they released me, but they told me not to go anywhere. And I'm like, what do you mean? They were like, they drafted John Michaels, first round draft pick, and they wanted me to stick around to see if he worked out. And I'm like, nah, I'm out. San Francisco picked me up. I left and went to San Francisco. Injuries happened there with defensive backs. They had to bring in more, so they had to make room on the roster. All right, we could let one tackle go and just keep one guard as a backup to both of them. I was a sacrifice. I love the sport so much. I went overseas and played for Barcelona, which was a great time. Just being, you know, we lived on the beach. We played football every weekend. I got paid. It was awesome. It was, you know, what's not to love. I did that for 2 years, and I finished my professional career in Canada. Coming home was surreal. It was the first time I thought I was depressed. Excuse me. It was the first time I thought I was depressed, because now for 10 years I traveled all over the United States, all over Europe, all over Canada, and now I returned with a U-Haul back to my parents' house, into my childhood bedroom, like, how did all of that just happen? You know what I mean? I got a knee injury that's not healing right. And I'm like, something's not good. And I just was didn't want to go out, didn't want to see people, didn't want to talk about it. What am I going to do next? Couldn't get a job. Nobody wanted to hire me. I was getting brought in for interviews. Oh, you're overqualified, but can you sign my autograph? Dude, I'm willing to pay. You're willing to pay for that job being done. I'm willing to do the job for that amount of money.
Right.
Hire me. My first job after playing in the NFL, after playing my football career, was a maintenance dude at an assisted living place, doing things like unclogging toilets and mopping floors and fixing picture frames and stuff like that. But I come from a humble blue-collar family. I have no problem with working hard. It's never been my problem. I'll work my butt off to earn my dollar. I don't want anything given to me. I'm okay with work. And then I went into construction, and I started as a dude just getting there before everybody to put out the tools. I didn't know anything about construction. Put out the tools to stay at, going to get their lunch, to clean it up after they're done.
Right.
Within a year, I was running a crew. Within 2 years, I was running three crews, and I loved the work I could do. I just feel my work ethic. If I watch you spackle a wall and it don't come out right, I can do it better.
Right.
You teach me the tricks of the trade and get out the way. Let me go. And I could do it all. I love building. I love doing it. And doing the maintenance job, I hurt my back. Thought I had a bruised, a pulled muscle, you know, football mentality, rub some dirt on it, keep going. A couple of weeks later, I started walking up the steps a little funny. I started swinging my leg, and I'm like, maybe there's something wrong. Like, a long story short, I did therapy. Then I went to aggressive therapy. Then I started seeing specialists. It wasn't getting worse, but it wasn't getting better. And maybe like 4 or 5 months later with this bad back, one day it just started going downhill. And within like 2-3 weeks, I was paralyzed. Lost everything from waist down. Now I get a dose of what real depression was, because now I can't move. I'm gaining weight. They don't know what's wrong with me. Boozing and taking pain pills to numb the pain. My lights, days, I don't open up my shades. I just didn't want to be bothered. And looking at a life in a wheelchair. And I'm like, damn, man, just a couple of years ago, I was running around playing football. And now here I am. I can't feel my feet. I'm urinating on myself. Just a bad, bad mix. And they finally found the problem. And they gave me a fusion in my thoracic spine, which they said it'll stop the paralysis from getting worse, but they don't think I'll ever walk again. And now I'm seeing therapists about getting the paddles in my car, the electric wheelchairs, and I'm like, nah, let's make this definite before we start doing all of this. And after my surgery, they call it manpower. Manpower came to get me out of my surgery bed into my hospital bed. I said, you guys see every morning? They were like, yeah. I'm like, can you come back tomorrow morning? They're like, for what? You're in your bed. I said, just come back. They came back. They called manpower. I said, can you just lift me up? If I'm never going to walk again, just lift me up and let my feet touch the ground and then put me back down. They had to get clearance from the doctor. They said, fine. He got hardware. He got screws, bolts, and nuts. It's not going to happen. And every day I'm like, yo, come back. Let my feet touch the ground. Let my feet touch the ground. And I'm like, I think I felt something. And they were like, all right, whatever. Put me back in the bed.
I believe in you, right?
And I just, you know, not saying I knew it was going to come back, but I just refused to take no for an answer. Now that mama mentality and thinking, when you're in a hospital bed and you have nothing to think about, a lot of stuff goes through your mind. So now I'm just focused on rehab and getting stronger and trying to wiggle my toes and trying to move my kneecaps and trying to flex my quads. And it slowly came back.
Learn how to walk again.
I had to learn how to walk all over again. They said it was pretty good that that happened. And I spent a couple of years building that back. In the beginning, I was still in a dark, funky, ugly place. And I saw a guy on the internet, Nick Wojcik. No arms, no legs. He had a little foot sticking out of his hip. And I seen him on top of a table, on top of a stage, telling able-bodied people how to live life. And I'm like, wow. This is powerful. The video behind him is showing him hopping out of a plane, going down ski slopes, parachuting. I'm like, how do you got no arms? How you parachute? Who's pulling the cord? Like, what's going on? Doing it with his mouth. And he didn't let anything stop him. I'm like, and I'm over here crying that I got all my limbs that, you know, I could feel them. You know, I can't feel them. And this guy has no limbs and he's living life. But at the end of his message was, if you want to get over your problem, help somebody else with theirs. So the day I started volunteering at Big Brother, Big Sister changed my life. I should have played Lotto that day because it changed my life. Everything got brighter. My heart started beating stronger. I just knew that that's what I was supposed to do. And if it wasn't for me going through my setbacks and what I was doing, I would have never had that mindset to do that. The day I started volunteering, it was a blessing, and that's why I selfishly do it now. It's not so much how much, don't get me wrong, I love helping people, but it's me being greedy because it's fuel for my soul too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And the more I do it and the more I help people engage in doing it, their eyes get brighter. They walk with a different walk in their step, and they're kind of like, yo, thank you so much. And I've mended families through volunteering. Guy had no relationship with his daughter. Wow. She went off to college, wouldn't even talk to him. She was coming home last Thanksgiving. I said, bring your daughter down to help volunteer. I'll ask her. Yeah, Dad, I would like to do that. They came down. He helped me unload some of the stuff. She volunteered, took stuff up to the rooms. They have a whole new relationship. Now he goes to her college. She got a nonprofit program going up at her college where she's doing feeding the homeless. They love it. They talk on the phone all the time. He's like, my life and my relationship with my daughter changed because of volunteering. And I'm like, do you know the power? Do you know how strong and how good that makes me feel? You know what I mean? And there's stories like that over and over and over again. So we do a lot of good work at Dream 68. And I'm proud and I'm happy. It makes my mother and father proud of what I do. But truthfully, it's me being
selfish. Yeah. Selfish. I say the same thing. To help others is the most selfish thing you could do because of the way that it makes you feel as a human being. It doesn't matter, you know, what that person looks like, how much money they make, where they're from. If you can change someone's day, and that could be something as simple as buying them a water, if they happen to be homeless or down on hard times, giving them $1, $5, and, you know, they're knocking on your window if it suits you, because, you know, there's some people seeking drugs. But my point is, when you put someone before you, and that could come in the form of your higher power, your children, or the people you help, it makes you feel that much better about yourself. So take us through this. You've walked us through after the league. You're working these jobs, and you're doing them with a smile on your face because this is your reality and you're cool with that. But the depression is starting to creep in because you miss the game. You miss those feelings. You miss being around
the brotherhood.
That mentality, quite honestly, that mama mentality. And champions. You were around champions, people that excelled in sports but also in life because of their championship mentality. And now, despite maybe, you know, differentiating yourself, not having that mama mentality while you were in the league, the shit popped up when you needed it the most, when you were probably at your darkest time, which is now you've given up on yourself, your body's given up on you to some extent, and the people around you, they're right in line with giving up on you, not walking again, because the doctors say you couldn't walk. I want to go back just a bit before we touch on Dream 68 and the foundation. How long does this recovery rehab process take you? How long does it take from your toes hitting the ground the first time and Manpower saying, all right, we'll do whatever you want, big dog. You think you're going to walk again? It's probably the thought in the back of the head. But something's telling you, I don't know if I'm going to walk again, but fuck it, I'm going to try.
I'm going to try.
The fight is coming out, the championship, the mama mentality is coming out. How long does that take?
So I was in a hospital from after my first surgery for about a month and a half. They wouldn't let me leave until, actually, I got out Christmas Eve because I was like, I don't know what I want to do this for Christmas is just be home in my bed.
Right.
And they were like, well, you got to get these shots every day. And unless you're going to give yourself these shots, you can't go. I'll do it.
Give me the needles. I'm out.
Yeah, well, you got to prove it to us you can do it. So I did it 3 days on my own, giving myself shots in the stomach. And this is all, I think, blood thinners or whatever. And they were like, all right, we'll send you home with a case. And we're good. And I got picked up Christmas Eve in a snowstorm. And so I was in a hospital a little over a month. And the rehab, you know, once I walked into my house, I remembered, you know, before going into the hospital, I'm like, no, I could get better, but I'm crawling on my stomach to go to the bathroom. I'm doing like crazy stuff like that just because I still was fighting it in my head. Now I come back after surgery like, well, I could feel some stuff moving. So my job is just to get better and go to rehab. So I had the ambulance picking me up every day to take me to rehab. The thing I missed about the hospital was I was in rehab twice and three times a day. Actually, I was in the hospital longer than that because I went from the hospital to a rehab center. And then from the rehab center, I spent about a month and a half.
So this is your full day? You're just not in the hospital sleeping there, but your whole day is centered around getting better?
Trying to get better. From breakfast, the diet, to the workout, to the physical therapy, the occupational therapy, the mental therapy, and all of that stuff, which, you know, was frustrating because I'm like, I just want to get better. You know what I mean? I don't want to deal with all of this, but it's needed, you know? So I did it with a smile, came home, and continued to do it. And went from a wheelchair to a walker to a rollator to a cane. And that whole process took probably about a year after I got released from the hospital. But I kept getting better. So at one point, I was like, look, my no hands. I could take steps. So I'm thinking that I'm going to walk any day. I'm going to lose my cane. And it just stalemated there. And I never got better and after that. And I accepted that. I was like, I could function. I could get around. I'm on my cane. I'm moving. I'm going to the gym. I'm riding bike. I'm swimming. I can make it happen.
Nick Vujicic.
Yeah.
And more to be thankful of than you have to be sorry for.
And a lot of it was my own problem because I'm a Super Bowl champion. I don't want people to see me in a wheelchair or a walker. The last thing I want to hear is, what happened? Like,
right. I'm sorry for you.
Come on. You know, don't worry about me. I'll be all right. Do I need help? No, I'm fine. I fall down. I'll be all right. I'm all right. I get up. You know what I mean? Like, I don't need your help. But I had to get out of my own way. And now I don't care who sees me. I walk out on a front stage with a walker, with a cane, whatever I have to do, because that was my mental blockage. Right. That was a Gary problem.
Right.
If somebody don't like what I'm doing, that's their problem. You know what I mean? But if I don't like what I'm doing, then I got to stop doing what I'm doing or I got to fix my mental aspect of it. So getting back to moving and doing all of that was great. It helped me the volunteering and the mentoring and the Dream 68 programs helped me get over my own issues and know that people were dependent on me. But, you know, nonprofits can be very costly. I had to shift to get something for profit.
My initial goal coming out of the gate was in the form of nonprofit. We're gonna do this. There's so much politics and stuff that I have no interest in dealing with, involved in that I shifted and pivoted to the podcast because I can shine a light on people like yourself who are in the trenches and doing God's work because they see the value in it. We do it selfishly, but selflessly, right? Because at the end of the day, yes, we're helping ourselves feel better, but we're also helping someone else. And by helping someone else, we're helping the world as a whole. We're putting good energy out there. So you go in this transition, your life after football, you've been called now. Dream 68, tell us a little bit more about that. When did that happen? What does that look like? Who do you serve out in the Long Island community now?
So it started as Dream 68 was started as a mentoring program because, like telling you, there was people in my life every step of the way, whether it was my father or Mr. John in junior high school, or even the coach that made it hard on me, there was always a mentor somewhere, somehow, helping me get to the next level. And I feel I owe it to my community that if I can help one kid fix his mindset and make him realize that dreaming, I don't care how big and how crazy it is, you can achieve it if you put yourself in the right position. So the idea came because in sixth grade I had to write a letter about what I wanted to do, what I wanted to be when I grew up. And it must have been after the Chicago Bears played on a Monday night football game where they were losing, and Jim McMahon came and put his headband around his neck after halftime, and they proceeded to kick their butt. They went on to win the Super Bowl, had the Super Bowl shuffle and all of that stuff, and the refrigerator Perry, and it was just, if there was an internet back then, they would have broke the internet.
85, baby. Yeah. Dating ourselves, but.
You know, but that was powerful, and it, everybody that had a headband on the next day put it around their neck.
Yeah.
So I must have wrote that sometime after that, whether a day or two after. But a later assignment was a self-addressed envelope. And those letters got mailed to us 20 years later. And to open that up and read that I wanted to be a professional football player after being a professional football player was like, whoa. Learning that the power of writing something down, the power of affirmation, the power of following your dreams, the power of putting yourself in the right position and situation to be successful, it's not easy, but it's not hard either.
Right.
You know, when you're hanging out with four people and your dream is to do this and they want to go do something stupid, is that going to take you away from your dream? Is that going to be something that if it goes wrong, you're not going to be able to follow your dream? Then that's a decision that you got to make right then and there, that's not for me, no matter what it is, whether it's hanging out, whether it's, you know, dealing with the wrong people, doing something stupid. It could be harmless, but if it's something that's going to take you away from your dream, why do it? There's always been somebody there for me, so I owe it to my community. And I started my mentoring program in Brentwood. Actually, I got my first college kid right now. I've been mentoring him since he was real young, and he's at Morgan State right now, which nice. Is amazing because they wanted to kick him out of school 4 years ago. And I'm like, how are you going to kick a little kid out of school? Like,
right.
He was just a practical joker. You know, he wanted to be funny, a little right. chubby kid. But graduated, just missed the honor roll, which is fine. You shot for it.
Yeah.
And went to Morgan State for the whole summer program, and now I'm enrolled in Morgan State. It's beautiful. You know what I mean? That's like, that shows, and his aunt calls and thanks me all the time. Like, yeah. I can't believe the young man that you raised and taught him how to do a bow tie, got him a suit for graduation, a suit for prom, sent him away with another, like, things that make young men men. Yeah. I think, you know, all of us as young men should know how to cook an egg, make a bed, clean a toilet, check the oil, change a flat, you know what I mean? And kids growing up without fathers don't learn these things.
Yeah.
Kids growing up with, you know, two parents working two jobs don't learn these things. Right. So if I can share that and add that to a value to them, why not? And just teach them. But it's also hard to mentor kids when they're hungry, when they're cold, when they're hot.
The basic necessities.
When they're, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old, raising kids, changing diapers and feeding kids till their parents come home 10, 11 o'clock at night. They're the babysitter. You know what I mean? Like, these kids are growing up in adulthood fast, you know? So it's a lot, and it's grew from a mentoring program to just taking care of underprivileged kids and their families.
Right. And from what I understand, you cover the gamut. There's not, like, one niche. I mean, if the community has a need, if a family has a need, you and the team are there to help them and lift them up however you can. One of the things I was researching before, you know, meeting up with you, and I wanted to ask you a little bit more about your Thanksgiving program, being that by the time this is released, that will be right around the corner. We want to shed some light on that, how people might be able to help, and what that program actually does, because you're going on 10 years now?
Yeah, this could be year 11, I believe.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so we took on the task one day sitting at a pizzeria, me and a couple of buddies, and we were like, oh, my buddy runs the shelter around the corner. I think we should feed them for Thanksgiving. Great idea. Let's have a meeting. Let's get set up. Let's get started. Everybody and their affiliates, long story short, people were talking about cooking in their kitchen at home and donating turkeys, different sizes, frozen, thawed out, 20 different vegetables. I said, whoa, this is not how we could do things. I contacted a guy I know from Oconee Manor, and he agreed to cook the food for me, volunteer his staff in his kitchen. And we bought the food, and he cooked everything down. The very next year, we served them that year. It was a hot mess what went on. But the very next year, I was like, guys, that was great. We're doing it again? They were like, no, we're going on vacation. We'll pay for you and your lady to go on vacation with us. I'm like, whoa, what about the shelter? He was like, all right, we did it. It was fun. We're done. And I've been doing it ever since on my own. And not on my, I shouldn't say my own. My organization's been doing it, but we're 100% volunteer-ran organization. Nobody gets paid. Nobody makes a dollar. All the money I raise is used for that purpose that it's raised for. We just did a big back-to-school program. I was lucky enough to get $1,000 from a donor. I bought $1,000 worth of $25 gift cards and donated them to the shelter, or two different shelters, because the kids are going to have things they need from teachers that are not in the list.
Yep.
So those 25, you could give them out per kid or per family or however you need to do it. And it doesn't have to just be used for back to school right now. It could be used later. So Thanksgiving, we feed 500-600 people. We get all volunteers to come down. The catering hall prepares the food, but we put it in microwavable safe dishes, because they don't have a stove there, all they have are microwaves. And we pack up meals that feed 3 to 4 people. And we make them up all the meals, drinks, dessert, cornbread, biscuits, whatever, everything, turkey, gravy, everything you need for Thanksgiving. And Thanksgiving morning, we show up 9 o'clock in the morning, all volunteers, and we hit the shelter, knocking on doors, and we have a list, room 108, family of 6, they get 2 bags. Room 210, family of 10, they get 3 bags.
How many shelters are you serving right now?
3.
Okay.
We started out in Brentwood, but now it graduated to, Family Service League took over that shelter since I've been feeding them. And so now I do the one in Brentwood, Smithtown, and West Babylon.
All right, well, you got to volunteer this year.
Awesome.
I'm coming through. Ironically, the last 7 Thanksgiving since we moved out to the island, we've had trouble starting a tradition. We tried hosting, we tried going, and we haven't figured out like that Thanksgiving Day stride. And this sounds like a beautiful thing. And I want to bring my kids.
Absolutely.
You know, you mentioned something very poignant, which was like helping people selfish, right? So what I realize is, I've become successful on some level, and, you know, not rich, because I can get around people with planes and, you know, all that other shit that, you know, considered you rich. But from where we come from, or where I come from, I'm considered rich. And it's all a relative term, right? You thought you had a great work ethic till you hit the NFL, and you're like, oh, shit, I got work to do. So I thought I've done well for myself till I get around people with real money, and I'm like, I've got work to do. And one of my challenges and my struggles internally has been, how am I gonna raise my kids to not be spoiled as fuck, weak as fuck, because they grew up with this privilege that I had no idea was. And my wife and I do the best job that we can, and we'll continue to do the best job that we can, knowing that we don't know it all. But I realized this, just like giving is selfish, the only way that I'm gonna get my kids to appreciate what they have is to bring them around situations and teach them how to help others.
Well, I think it's important. I look to kids to volunteer more first because it does a couple of things. One, God forbid the kid is ever in a situation where they need help. They'll know how to ask for it before it's too late. A lot of times people ask for help as a last resort, and getting ahead of it is easier and better to do. Two, best case scenario, they do well for themselves in life, but they have that give back seed in them, and they always remember that they're fortunate and they have it, and there's people that aren't, and they'll tend to always, you know, think about it, and give back when they can.
Right.
I think those are two very important things. So kids come, and my first rule of thumb is you may see something here or someone here that you had no clue is in the shelter. What you see here stays here. And, you know, respect the people. No photos, no this, no that. We talked about the politicians and, yeah, I got $500 without catching a picture with a homeless. Nobody wants to be the poster child of a homeless shelter, bro.
Correct.
Thank you, but no thank you for your $500.
Right.
We could do without it. You know what I mean? I'll pay it for myself before I take it from you. And you know, it's funny. Some of them will walk away with a check and be like, oh, well, then I can't do this. Then, all right, you're paying for a photo op.
Right.
I want workers. You're not going to even...
You're not doing any real work.
Check.
Right, right, right.
Stay and volunteer.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, what kind of person are you? You
forget
know?
The pictures.
Yeah, you know.
What's this feel like when you're out there serving?
And that's what I'm trying to do. And if I could introduce that, and the truth of the matter is, everybody wants to give. Majority of people want to help out and give, yeah. Donate or whatever. But if I can bring it to them for them to make the transaction right then and there, make it easy for them, I'll get 99% participation.
Right.
If they got to go outside the door to do it, I'm going to lose like 20%.
Right.
God forbid if they have to cross the street to do it, I'm going to lose like half the per- And if they got to go out of their way, and it's the truth.
It's the sad truth.
Because people are busy in life, and I respect their time, and I respect their hustle, and they, you know, do I make a left to help, or do I make a right to go do what I want to do? I'm going to make a right to go do what I want. And that's their life, and I'm not knocking that. But I use myself as a vessel to just try and make it easier for them. My networking group, you got clothes to donate, you got supplies to donate, you got checks, bring it here Wednesday. My truck, all the seats are down in my truck, because every Wednesday this thing gets flooded with God knows what, but I find a home for it.
For any of the listeners who are listening or watching and you're in the New York City metropolitan area, any donations that you have, keep us in mind. We're going to include the links below, anything, because how many times do we just pull up and throw them in those big bins that are sitting around in some mall shopping lot, shopping center mall, parking lot rather, and we don't know where that stuff is going. But I can guarantee you if we put it in this man's hands or some of the people that he works with, it's going to be put to good use. So
absolutely.
Keep us in mind for that, especially with fall, winter, holiday season coming up. So Dream 68's been around for over a decade now, doing good in the community. What does your vision look like for the next, you know, 5-10 years? I always ask my guests, because when you're doing good, you tend to be in the moment, putting out fires. And maybe that, correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't allow you to treat it the same way as maybe a business venture, where you say, well, this is my 5-year plan for doing good. So what do you see?
So the beauty about what I did was it was mine. And the reason it was mine, because, like I said, things happen. I have friends steal from me, over, you know, from my nonprofit, which made me learn more about nonprofits and get involved with American Red Cross, get involved with the Guide Dog Foundation, and things like that, which taught me the back end and ins and outs. So me having total control of Dream 68 helped me grow slowly and organically. So I've mastered the Thanksgiving thing. Every year I try and add something more to the mix, from Thanksgiving to Christmas to back to school to football. I do free football camps in the summertime. It's free to everybody because I don't want any kid to be excluded because of how much it costs.
Right.
You start getting into pricing, $20 or $100 or $150, now you're competing with other people for the wrong reasons, and that's not what we're doing. We're here for the kids. Parents, off the field. I don't want to deal with you. I'm here. You're signing up to give me your kids
I
for 3 hours.
Now they're trying to live,
you know,
with their
mean?
Kids on the sidelines.
Like, you know,
oh, man, it's crazy in the
go
suburbs.
Go have a cup of coffee. Go do what you got to do, but you're not on my field.
Right.
And you know, so I add something every year, fundraisers, and we do a lot of good work. 5 years, I want to master what I have already. Getting it to be self-ran and have other people help run it. You know, this is costly. I get donations now, but I haven't always gotten donations, so I was the donor, you know what I mean? So I do a lot of for-profit things. You see my event space that I have in Long Island. That's a goal of mine to grow. But with that being said, I want to grow a nonprofit networking group for small to medium network. I mean, nonprofits that have struggles like I've struggled, like you've talked about the struggles of having a nonprofit, not knowing how to do this or lacking that, or not having the funding or the backing. You know what? Because I'm doing a nonprofit for underprivileged kids does not mean I'm not sensitive to cystic fibrosis, where one of my first cousins passed away from, or I'm not sensitive to breast cancer that my girl and her mother dealt with, you know? So I don't want to pigeonhole myself. We can all work together. I'm so stuck on this team atmosphere, this team theme, because I come from a team mentality. And the good thing about nonprofits is a lot of times it put a lot of good-hearted people in the room that want to give, that want to participate. They just don't know how. But if you could give them direction, give them leadership, you can go a lot further. They say, if you want to go fast, go by yourself. If you want to go far, go with others. And I'm thinking of, I'm already in the works of starting something that's going to be, you know, positive to the community, that's going to help all these organizations that help other organizations, if that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. And similar to my vision and goal for Real Mentors Podcast is to shed a light on all the other things already being done. Instead of picking a niche, picking this, we pick all the areas of growing up, underprivileged that we can address, because there's so many. Yeah. There's just so many things that make a championship mentality. It's not the physical component to it. It's more mental, but you also got to be physically, you know, ready and able-bodied. And it's a process. And, you know, without mentors, without people like yourself that are, you know, giving of themselves to make things better for others, a lot more people will get lost to the way things are than need to. So if you're listening right now and you don't think that you have the power to change your life, you are sadly mistaken. Everybody that you come in contact with, you have the ability to change that person's life in the moment. So don't discount your ability to make change in the lives of others or do good in the world. So, Gary, it's been an absolute pleasure having you. How can people find you? Where can they find you? And most importantly, if they want to help, how can they help?
Social media, you can always find me, Gary Brown, Dream68. You can always look me up, send me an email if it's something personal, something you want to dive into. It would be Gary Brown, Gary Big Brown, Dream68 at gmail.com. I'm sure I screwed that up, but I'm going to send you the link.
Say it again for us.
Gary Big Brown 68 at gmail.com. And that is a way to get in touch with me through email. You can always look me up on social media, Instagram, Facebook. There's not many Gary Brown Dream 68s that play for the Packers, so it'll be easy to find. We're always looking for new ventures. And if you need help, if I can't help you myself, I will point you in the right direction, because that's what we do.
Yeah, Gary has been a very great guest. He's somebody I'm going to be working closely with. You heard it here first. I'm volunteering for Thanksgiving.
Absolutely.
So there's no bullshitting around the fact that I'll be helping out this Thanksgiving. If you get a chance, go support the book, Reflections of a Champion by Gary Brown. He's also a public speaker and a great one in his own right. So stay tuned. Real Mentors Podcast, always bringing you people that are making change, making a difference in the community. How can you go out there and make a difference today? Thank you guys for tuning in. Thank you, Gary. Appreciate you, brother.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Stay tuned.